This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and my guest today on The Breakfast Grill is Hugh Payman, author of the book China's Change, The Greatest Show on Earth. Thank you so much, Hugh, for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
I want to begin with an assumption that sort of underscores the book. There is an implicit critique of the West and of democracy. And I wonder if we could explore that for a little while before we get into China, the X factor, its history, and why you seem to be so bullish on China.
Well, there are many elements to the question, so if I can just take a couple of them and maybe we return to the others. It's not so much a critique of the West or even of democracy itself, because you certainly need accountability in any system. Malaysia knows that, right? I think it's much more what I'm trying to say to people in each community around the world, not any specific country, that you mustn't forget what you yourself knew. What am I meaning? When I wrote the introduction for the book, which you probably know always gets written last, and you discover what the book might be about, hopefully what it is about, I found myself realizing that I have, in the book, come up, because I've been essentially a consultant most of my life, with a list of 20 ideas, essential ideas, for understanding change. Not understanding China, understanding change. And when I looked at all these, and maybe later we can get into some of the individual ones, I realized that this was exactly the same ideas that drove Western economic dominance since 1800. Long-term thinking, vision, gradualism. It wasn't about democracy, because the West didn't have democracy then, certainly in the form we know it today. So what I'm trying to say to people, and I think very relevant for Malaysia today, is think back to how you've faced challenges before. Some of them major, some of them not so major. So, for instance, I would argue that after 1969, Malaysia had a rethink. And then we had the new economic policy. No policy lasts forever. It always needs to be upgraded. And again, you'll see that's one of the principles that traditional Chinese thought has, but others do too. So this is not about Chinese exceptionalism. It's not saying that anyone has got things wrong. It's just that if you look back to your own recent history or even ancient history, you will find that most societies, when they've had to face major challenges, have actually ended up looking at some, not always all the same, similar ideas.
Okay, well, if we could dwell on the West for a moment more. You start your history, as you said, before, in fact, the advent of democracy. Mm. And we've had understanding of the West and its tumultuous history that included the formation of nation states, this idea of how these nation states should relate to each other, some sort of compact. But then you see that compact falling apart and the great wars were fought on the soil of Europe, at least. What did that history tell us about the kind of form of government that we have today and internationally? All the things that really make up, even Malaysia's position in the world. It has to consider not just its domestic dynamics, but also external dynamics.
If I was to take just one lesson for today, as opposed to all the lessons it taught us in the past to get to today, I would say that, first of all, change is inevitable. And however successful one is at the beginning, think of Chinese dynasties. All the great dynasties started off being successful, and then they fell into decline. So what today do I think is probably the most overlooked factor around the world in not so much political systems, but in countries? It's left behind communities. It's just inevitable in change and in transformation that some are going to be left behind. But then you have to address that. And again, this is why accountability is so important in terms of systems, however you do that. Of course, the thing that the West had in the 19th century, early 20th century, even mid to late 20th century, was they strengthened institutions, which I think is a very relevant thing in Malaysia today. So I'd say if you were to ask me about one thing that the West both learned and arguably over the last two or three decades has started to lose, doesn't mean it's lost it completely, but has started to lose, is that perspective that there is this constant transformation of change. And to be able to manage that, you have to be mindful of many things, but in particular that there are people who are left behind and who are going to resist it.
You know, I'm very interested to know who you're in conversation with. Are you in conversation with those who perhaps push back against this idea that change is inevitable? People like Francis Fukuyama, who several decades ago kind of like imagined that, in fact, we're reaching the pinnacle of human society in terms of political economy, that liberal democracies are going to rule and basically be the dominant form for the foreseeable future. I mean, are you in conversation with people like that or, in fact, even Martin Jakes, you know, who's written that book, When China Rules the World. Is that who you're talking to?
I'm talking to the local audience in every place I sell my book. That's my audience. Of course, to begin with, I was thinking of my home audience in the West, because that's really where I think my voice may resonate more. I'm not here to lecture people.
You're European, essentially.
By origin, from Britain. But so that's what I know. But I also think that in what I call post-economic miracle Asia, people can look back to their recent past. How did they overcome some of these things before? And even with Fukuyama, his more recent writings, he finds, as you probably know, considerable fault in the American system. It was a great essay to write in 1989. It was so prescient, and he got a lot of praise for it. I'd give him more praise for the fact that he is changing his ideas, but he's not imposing a system. I think that's what's important. And in the book, I think one of my great discoveries for me was this is not about policy. Policy is important, but first of all, you have to have a process that works for your society. And that will differ. There may be some common elements. I don't dispute that. But you have to think, what will work here and now?
You were based here some years ago when you worked with Faizan Economic Review. And you're, in some ways, an old Asia hand, if that's not a too condescending or odd a term to use these days. What about the other Asian, sort of the hefty Asian countries like India?
Yes.
Again, long histories, complex characteristics, but claimant to the most populous democracy of the world, something that China isn't. Does China pose a problem for you intellectually? Do you think about what China is today? What India is today?
It's not a problem. It's a challenge for my thinking. I've known India. I've been involved in India since the mid-1980s. So I find it very interesting, compare and contrast. But you mentioned the word complexity. This is the key to it. And again, if I can say, many Western societies think that everything is so simple and we've achieved everything. That's their mistake. In India, I think people are aware that there is the complexity. People have different paths. I quote in my book one of my favorite stories, which comes from 1943, when Winston Churchill sent Joseph Needham to Chongqing. He was a Cambridge academic who then went on to write a very, very famous 21-volume history of Chinese science and technology. To get to Chongqing, where the universities had retreated in the face of the Japanese invasion, he, first of all, had to get to Calcutta, which must have been quite a journey in 1943, but then he had to go over the hump of the Himalayas. So he arrives in Chongqing, you know, all shaken up. He's been in an old DC-47, probably through thunderstorms. And the British ambassador says to him, take your time over the afternoon. Go and sit in the garden, you know, and I'll see you later in the day. So Needham goes and sits down. I don't know, he probably had papers or books. And he looked up and he saw the gardener who was grafting. Now, Needham knew about grafting. And he looked at him and said, he's doing it all wrong. No, no, you don't do it like that. Went back to his book. Then he looked up. And he was still doing it the same way. And he thought, but he's the head gardener. And China has been growing fruit far longer than Britain has. Went back to his book, thought about it, and he thought, okay, my first lesson in China. Different isn't necessarily wrong. So I think that there has to be a starting point when we look at things. It's still up to individual people themselves, but they will make that decision, particularly in the era of social media. It's a bit different from how things were seen in the Cold War of essentially absolutist states.
There's another thing about the 20th century. It was a century of ideology.
Yes.
Change was something that could be approached in a programmatic fashion. You had socialism, you had national socialism, Nazism, you had all kinds of visions for the world that were either democratic or totalitarian, but they were programmatic ones. Is that era over? Can we still think of change in programmatic terms?
I don't think we can think in ideological terms if we're looking at China. I'm not saying elsewhere, but in terms of China. Because why has China's economy stayed on the rails, having traveled at such high speed for so long? Record-breaking, given the scale. Other people have grown at similar growth rates. South Korea had a tear, let me assure you. But it's not quite the same scale. I would put it down to the fact that it was pragmatism. Something that the British used to pride themselves on, particularly in the 19th century. It was realism, and it was also gradualism. China has had plenty of ideology in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. They're not thinking in ideological terms. People may dispute the definition and say, well, any idea is an ideology, but not an ideology as you identified in the 20th century.
I'm speaking to Hugh Payman, author of the book China's Change, The Greatest Show on Earth. Next, we look at China's X Factor. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutan. Together with me is Hugh Payman, author of the book China's Change, The Greatest Show on Earth. The two fallacies that you outline about China, it's often said about China, is that China is destined to rule the world, and the other is that China is fatally flawed. Two opposed visions of the country. Are you suggesting the golden mean, a kind of middle path in terms of understanding China?
You could say that, but what I'm really thinking about is that if you don't have change, you're going to hit road bumps, and then you're going to hit buffers, and then you're going to come off the tracks. So it's this ability to think in terms of change. After all, China wrote the I Ching, 136 BC, but these ideas had been collected for 2,000 years. And although they started out how you define the future, rulers discovered that wasn't very successful. So other people, who were essentially strategic thinkers, started to write commentaries on life. So that's what is always there in Chinese thinking. It is there in other thinking. But for China, this is, if you like, their default position. How do you manage change?
We were talking about the pragmatism that you say marks the Chinese Communist Party today, or they're thinking about change. But we also have the rise of Xi Jinping as president, and he's perhaps more a child of Mao Zedong than he is of Deng Xiaoping, say some of his critics, and his decision to elevate himself, his thinking, his you know, what is likely to be more than one, two terms as leader of China. Does that change the story for you, the rise of Xi Jinping?
Quite some time ago, I think it was about 2009, I asked a very senior official in Taiwan, what do you think of Xi Jinping? I knew he had done his research. And he told me a lot of things, had a long list of things. And then I said, so which way do you think he'll go? And he said, the question you have to answer is, not as you said, if I may say, he's the son of Mao, is he his father's son? Because you know the history of his father. He was detained and then imprisoned for 14 years when Xi Jinping was the age of 11. So I think that you have to be able to think of Xi in terms of his own history, which of course is his own family history. And I think this is what is missed in the West. If you go back to all the successful Chinese dynasties, starting with the Han, the first thing they did was to centralize power. Because the problems arose largely because at the peripheries, nobody listened to the center. So I don't jump to the conclusion that Xi is necessarily, at heart, an ultra-authoritarian. In fact, actually the opposite. But in order to have the power to push through ideas, of which probably the most important one is the rule of law. Now, people can just laugh and say it's not going to happen. But that was, you know, the third plenum in 2013. He knew he had to have the rule of law, sorry, 2014. Why? Because you cannot have a modern, complex economy without the rule of law. That was the conclusion that many people in China, in the technocracy, had come to. So to me, when I write China's Change, it is very much the view of an economist, which I understand there are many limitations of that. But by looking at how the technocrats, as a group, have seen what they need to do to change China, I think it's much easier to see what Xi Jinping not so much has done, but is going to do. And that we don't know. But I would argue that this idea of dictator for life is as flawed as people who think that, you know, China's got everything completely right.
In the very early part of your book, and you say China's driven by demanding consumers, dynamic private companies, and new technologies. That is a very interesting formulation, but it leads up this a word that we've become very familiar with in Malaysia of late, citizens, citizenry. Why do you not put citizens there? Why do you use consumers as opposed to citizens?
Because the reality today is it's the consumers. Their children may start to use the word citizens quite easily. 15, 20 years ago, nobody talked about consumers because there weren't any, really. So everything evolves in stages, as opposed to everything is either black or white and stays that way. I say, and there's plenty of evidence for this if you want it, that the Chinese consumers are the most demanding on earth. Why? Because they've been denied for so long. They know what is now available, not just by travel, but by social media, putting everything in front of them. And they will demand things just like societies elsewhere, maybe to some extent in the context of their own society, but many of them will be very similar.
Hugh, in the remaining minutes that we have, I want to get to this intriguing expression used, China's X factor. What did you mean by that?
What I meant is that China has a process. They don't talk about it as a process, by the way. This is purely my interpretation. I took those 20 essential ideas. I asked an academic in London, what do you think of these? He said, oh, far too many. So I said, well, how many can I have? Hoping he'd say 10 or 15. He said, three. So I said, okay, I greatly respect him. So I said, I must get these 20 down to three. So I cheated a little bit. I just took headings and everything else as a subhead. And it's a good way of thinking about it. First of all, the goals. So for Malaysia today, what are the goals? Not what are China's goals, what are Malaysia's goals? Then, once you've got strong support, and I mean this from the whole society, I don't just mean from a few people at the top, then you have to say, what are the means to achieve those goals? Now, to achieve means, first of all, you have to crystallize those ideas. You can't have a fuzzy concept. And that means a lot of preparation. It means a lot of research and field work, as the Chinese go. You look back to your own past. You look at other people's experience. And you work out what needs to be done. Then you have to implement it. And China is famous, not unique, but famous for pilot schemes, because they know you don't have the instant answer. Otherwise, it would have been tried before, right? So you have the means, and then you have the people. You have to have the leadership. You have to have the education so that people can really understand all the complexity behind these ideas. Because I think that one of the great problems of many societies is that not only have we become so short-term in our thinking, but we've also lost the ability to think through what could be the unintended consequences.
Now, finally, you know, when you look at China today, what do you think could be their greatest challenge? What could derail China at this point in time?
First of all, what I've said, if it doesn't continue to change. Secondly, what development economists of my generation used to say, the problem of rising expectations. As people get richer, they demand more and more, not happier and happier. And so this is the tiger that China has to ride, like every society. I would say that those two are the two biggest problems they face, because these are internal issues, nothing to do with the outside world. Let's accept the fact that the world is in a period of accelerating disruption for reasons that we all understand, the transfer of wealth from the West to the East. Demographics are changing. We've got technological change. And then, of course, you know, we've got all that flows from the innovation.
Thank you very much, Hugh, for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Hugh Payman, author of the book China's Change, The Greatest Show on Earth. I'm Sharad Kutan. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, Frost & Sullivan Malaysia's mobile data service provider of the year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.